I was at peace. 11 frames, 11 seconds. Then I came. I woke up. Wow. All the elements of the nightmare. But it was a wet dream. Green light, what does it mean? I wondered. There were two things I was sure, but in the dream, one I was on the Amazon River, and two, those were African tribesmen on the ridge. I got out of bed and grabbed my world atlas, then turned to the continent of Africa and started looking for the Amazon. Well, as you probably know, you can look a mighty long time for the Amazon River in the continent of Africa, because you're not going to find it. I looked for that river for 2 hours until I realized. Wrong continent. The Amazon's in South America. Damn, dreams can be tricky. Nevertheless, it was a sign and just what I was looking for. It was time to chase down my wet dream. Note to self. Just because the seats are empty doesn't mean they're not taken. Sometimes the guest list needs to be for one. I crammed my backpack with minimal clothing. My journal, camera, medical kit, a head of ecstasy, and my favorite headband, then embarked on a 22-day solo trip to Peru to find and float. The Amazon River. Yeah, the one in South America. I flew to Lima, then on to Cusco, where I met a guide, and we mapped out my 3-week journey to the Amazon River over Anticuchos and Pisco. I hiked the Andes and along the Obama River into the lost city of Machu Picchu, listening to John Mellencamp's Aha album on my Walkman as I climbed. Then I took a bus, boat, and a plane ride to get to the largest city in the world. You can't get to by car. You keep those. The Peruvian capital of the Amazon. It was the 12th night of my 22-day adventure, and I was settling into camp. I had already hiked over 80 miles to this point, and tomorrow I'd finally be in the waters of my wet dream, the Amazon River. Up to this point in the trip, I had had a hard time being present. So excited in anticipation of what the Amazon would mean to me, I had missed most of the beauties getting here. Still wrestling with my identity. I was guilt-ridden over sins of my past, lonely and disgusted with the company. I was keeping my own. In my tent, grappling with my demons, I couldn't sleep, so I quit trying to. Instead, I stripped off my clothes along with every badge, banner, expectation, and affiliation I had on me. I discarded my American baseball cap that was my total into patriotism. The Celtic knot pendant that symbolized my Irish heritage, the Lone Star flag amulet that stood for my Texas pride, and every other mascot of inspiration from adventures past. I even discarded the gold ring my father had given me that was made from a meltdown of his and mom's class rings in gold from one of her teeth. I removed every idol that ever gave me comfort and security, pride or confidence. All the window dressings and representations, the packaging around my product was gone. I even punched myself in the face a couple of times for good measure. Who was I not only in this trip, but in this life? Now naked and stripped down to nothing. I was only a child of God and nothing more. Soaked in a cold sweat, I vomited until there is no bile left in my belly. Then passed out from exhaustion. Note to self, sometimes we have to leave what we know to find out what we know. A few hours later, I awoke on the 13th morning to a rising sun. Surprisingly fresh and energized. I dressed, made some tea, and went for a morning walk. Not toward my destination or any expectation, but rather to nowhere in particular. I felt great, alive, clean, free, right. Walking along a muddy path, I turned a corner, and there in the middle of the trail was a marriage of the most magnificent pinks and blues and red colors I had ever seen. It was electric, glowing and vibrant, hovering just above the jungle floor pool, seeming as if it was plugged into some neon charge power plant. I stopped, I stared. I backed up a base. There's no way around it, and it was no mirage at all. The jungle floor in front of me was actually a kaleidoscope of thousands of butterflies, was spectacular. I stayed a while gaping and wonder captivated. I heard this little voice inside my head say these words. All I want is what I can see. All I can see is in front of me. No longer in a rush to get anywhere or anticipating what was around the corner coming up next or up ahead, time slowed down. I raised my chin to the sky and said a quiet thank you, then glanced down the path just past the massive menagerie of levitating butterflies, and there for the first time. I saw the Amazon River. The tower of all my anxieties, now laying down laterally in front of me just like that slow-moving river. For the first time in months, I was at ease. A few hours later, I returned to camp to pack for my continued journey. On arrival, my guide called out to me in Spanish. So I lose my tail, so lose meaning you are light, Matthew, you are light. Now forgive, and I'd let go of the guilt. My confusion was gone. My penance felt paid back in good graces. I shook hands with myself from that morning on. I was present, embracing only what I could see in front of me and giving it the justice it deserved. For the next 2 weeks I hiked, canoed, and even macheted my way through the Amazon rainforest on my one hit of ecstasy. And yes, I floated naked on my back, down the Amazon River. But no snakes, crocodile sharks, or piranhas enveloped me as they had in my dream. I guess they didn't have to anymore. On the final day, while bathing in the river, I did see what looked to be the final wave of a mermaid's tail as it slid beneath the water surface heading downriver. I waved back. I had crossed a truth that I find it, I don't know, I think it found me. Why? Because I put myself in a place to be found, I put myself in a place to receive it. How do we know when we cross the truth or a truth crosses us? I believe the truth is all around us all the time. The anonymous angels, the butterflies, the answers are always right there, but we don't always identify, grasp, hear, see or access them because we're not in the right place too. We have to make a plan. Green light prescription. / prayer. God, when I cross the truth, give me the awareness to receive it. The consciousness to recognize it, the presence to personalize it, the patience to preserve it, and the courage to live it. First, we have to put ourselves in the place to receive the truth. This noisy world we live in, with its commitments, deadlines, fixed, this is due. That's an expectations. Make it hard to get clarity and peace of mind, famous or not. So we have to consciously put ourselves in a place to receive that clarity. Whether that's prayer, meditation, walkabout, being in the right company, a road trip, whatever it is, for each of us. Then after we put ourselves in this place to listen to the gospel and hear their music, we then have to be aware enough to receive it. And conscious enough to recognize it. It will arrive nameless because it is clear, omnipresent, unanimous and infinite. It usually lands like a butterfly, quick and quiet when we let it in, it needs no introduction. Then the relationship can begin and we need the presence to personalize it. This is where the anonymous truth gets intimate and becomes autonomous. We ask ourselves what it means, how it's unique to us, and why it's here now. Then comes the harder part. Having the patience to preserve it, getting it from our intellect into our bones, soul and instinct, we must pay attention to it. Concentrate on it, keep it lit, and not let it flutter away. This takes time, commitment and tendance. If we make it this far after we put ourselves in the right place to receive the truth, recognized it as such, made it our own, and preserved it, then comes the coup de grace. Having the courage to live it, to actually walk away from that place where it found us, take that truth with us into the screaming arena of our daily lives. Practice it and make it an active part of who we are. If we can do that, then we are on our way to heaven on earth, where what we want is what we need. Or what we need is what we want. I returned to Hollywood and soon made the decision to play the role of Palmer, Joss, opposite Jodie Foster and Robertson Mexus Contact after my spiritual journey on the Amazon. My choice to inhabit a man who believed in God and the world of science was very close to the truth of where I was in my own life and where I wanted to spend my time in front of the camera. Jodie Foster was the clear lead and people questioned why I took the girl's role, as they called it at the time, instead of taking other leading roles I was being offered. But I was more than satisfied with my choice, as I was interested in what I termed philanthropic roles and stories of self-discovery, as well as working with great directors. After we wrapped filming, I continued canoeing rivers, only now I was ready to row the highways of the United States. So I bought a 1996 GMC Savannah van and tricked it out to suit my fancies. I gutted the interior except for the two front captain chairs and installed a custom-made console with a hideaway cooler and rain. A PA system like I had in my high school truck, and a Rode and Tijuana shock-mounted microphone on the end of a bendable arm connected to a cassette recorder that was mounted into the ceiling of the driver's seat. So I could make high-end voice recordings while driving down the road. Many have been transcribed and are in this book. I spent 10 grand on an Alpine EP10 credit equalizer info, Cowie speakers for a top invented sound system. Fixed a leopard skin couch bed in the back and drilled a hole in the floor to fit an oil funnel so I could take a pee without having to pull over. I named that van Cosmo. And Miss Hayden, I hit the road. Note to self. I've never cared much for destinations. The idea of landing is too finite for my imagination, and sense of song give me a direction and a 16-lane highway with room to swerve and explore along the way. Like jazz, I prefer to see life as a river. After a few months reversing the states and either sleeping on that leopard skin bed or in a motel, Miss Hud and I decided we were ready to commit to being RD dogs, so we upgraded. purchased a 28-foot Airstream International CCD, hooked it up to the back of Cosmo, and towed our new home on the road behind us. Now fully self-sufficient, Ms. Hud and I became what the trailer world calls full-timers. We carve trails from Manitoba to Guatemala and 48 of the 49 reachable United States of America in between our compass. Wherever we wanted to go, our schedule whenever we wanted to go there. Roger Clemens pitching in New York 3 days from now. Well, that's a 3-day drive from Albuquerque, New Mexico, so we'll head out in the morning and make the game. Hey, there's a cult concert in Detroit the next night. Perfect, we'll swing by for that the day after Clemens takes the bump. I also took my meetings with film directors on the road. For instance, if I was in Utah and headed east, I would schedule my guest to fly into, say, Boulder, Co. the next morning and pick them up at the local airport. Then we would drive together and discuss the project for the next 7 hours until I drop them off the airport in Lincoln, Nebraska for their flight home. Behind the steering wheel has always been my favorite seat, and driving the highways of America has always been my ideal office. We went on location to Rhode Island, where I got to work with Steven Spielberg on Amistad, a film about a slave revolt aboard a Spanish schooner in 1839, and a case that reached the Supreme Court became notable in the abolition movement. I also made the Newton Boys with my old friend who gave me my first shot in the business, Richard Linklater. It was about an outlaw gang of brothers who were the most successful training bank robbers in history. The man our portrayed was Willis Newton, who was from my hometown of Yew Valley, Texas, one of the originators of outlaw logic. He'd rather shoot the lock than use a damn key any day. Miss Hodney enjoyed boondocking in the trailer park life, especially the people we met and observed along the way. For me, this was acting and storytelling. 101, a front row seat to real characters and real life. It was live. Not Memorex behavior, not attitude. I wrote my diary and recorded in my mic daily. Trailer parks are full of renegades, runaways, professional clowns, rock band guitarists down on their lockers. Wildlife lovers, 4 p.m. tailors, book readers, retired couples, single mothers, unicyclers, inventors, partners, gardeners, dreamers, Los Sols, hippies, motorheads, meth cookers, million milers, and iron your own suit. At 6 a.m. arse, one thing they all appreciate is minding their own business and you minding yours. If the door shut, don't come knocking is one of the first rules or trailer park living. Sure, I heard Matthew McConaughey staying in the park many times, but after a few waves and head-high hotties, everyone always respected my privacy because for the most part, everyone honored trailer park rules when they didn't. The rest of the park let him know. On the other hand, if you did want to meet people, in the words of Bobby Thin Lizzie Robinson at the Lazy Days, Mobile Home Park in Quartzsite, Arizona, just open the hood of your truck. Plenty of people come by to help you. Miss Harden, I took our time on the road and went where we pleased when we wanted to keep in the shiny side eye. The rubber side low, and if you ever get in a rush, just leave early, just like Robbie Cricket McKenzie told us when we were pulling out of a creekside trailer park in Gadsden, Alabama. Note to self. Common sense is like money and health. Once you have it, you gotta work to keep it. On one film shoot, Miss Hodney settled into the trailer park on the Squamish Nation Indian Reserve just south of the Second Narrows Bridge in Vancouver, Canada. The chief of the reservation, Mike Hunt. Yes, that was his name, and I soon became buddies living on the river. The Squamish were adept fishermen, but they've become particularly efficient at the art of catching coho salmon. Instead of venturing out into their canoes with bait and hooks, they now walked into the shallow stream and simply lined up an alley of stones leading into the open entrance of an abandoned shopping cart from the local supermarket. It wasn't much of a sport. None at all really, but it was highly reliable. I would cook beef rib eye steaks on the outdoor grill of my Airstream and trade them for coho salmon, freshly captured in the steel baskets on wheels. One day a paparazzo moved into the trailer park, looking to snap pictures of me. Chief Hunt and his brothers went to him and told him he was not welcome on the reservation. Why, the paparazzo asked? Because we are a tribe here and you are making one of our brothers uncomfortable. Well, too bad, the paparazzo defended. I pay my rent and this is a free country. Not on this reservation. It is not. Chief Ant and his brothers escorted the guy off the reservation that night. Not only did I never see him again, he never saw me. He didn't get a single photo. 6 weeks later, when I was done filming and packing up to leave, Chief Mike and his brothers gave me a parting gift, a hand-carved canoe paddle engraved with the Squamish Nation's Thunderbird symbol. This paddle is what gives the Squamish Nation its direction on the water. Chief Hunt said, "May this be your compass and watch over you on your travels, Brother Matthew." From that day on, I have affectionately called my 28-foot International CCD Airstream the canoe. Green light bumper sticker time. Localize to customize. Adapt to modify the Renaissance. Man is at home wherever he goes. It was just after sundown, somewhere along the Clark Fork River in western Montana. I'd been driving since 8 that morning, so I was pretty tired and looking for a trailer park to stretch, rest and catch the last Pac-12 college football game on my satellite TV. With the last town too far behind me and the next 150 miles ahead, I was in the middle of nowhere when I saw a campground sign and my headlights on the right. I immediately slowed down and took the dark dirt road off the highway. I drove down the pitch-black pine tree-lined trail until the path was no more. I stopped, looked around, no one, no facilities, nothing. Miss Hodney got out of Cosmo. The canoe hitched behind us to suss out the situation and look for a clue. Nothing. Then through the pine forest about 40 yards farther into the woods, I saw the small radiating orange ebb and flow ember of a cigarette being smoked. I killed the ignition, locked the doors, and with Miss Hud at my side headed for the glow. On approach, I noticed a figure in an all-white chef's uniform smoking, leaning against the wall, left leg straight, right knee bent, reminding me and my brother Pat back in high school as soon as I got within earshot. The figure asked, "You looking for a spot?" "Yeah," I said with an open southern sky from a satellite dish. Without a nudge in his stance or pause in his puff, he motioned his head high and right. "Talk to Ed at the bar, he'll set you up." Miss Hodney headed in that direction and came to a large hardwood door in the side of the same massive barn-like structure. The chef was leaning against. I opened it and a wave of light music and revelry came blaring out. It was a tavern and it was Saturday night with thick enough walls to not know it until you were in it. The place was packed hopping. We stepped inside and looked for the bar when the big brown, welcoming eyes of a Cheyenne barmaid bounced up and introduced yourself. "Hi, I'm Asha. Come on in, anything I can get you?" "Yeah," I said, "I'm looking for addition." She nodded across the room, "That's him behind the bar over there." I glanced up to the busy bar and then to the back of the balding long gray-haired head behind it. "Thanks, Asha, sure need anything." "Let me know," she said winking as she danced back into the fray. Miss Hart at my heel, we crossed the bar. "Hey Ed," I raised my voice to get his attention over the hubbub. "Yeah, what do you want?" Head yelled from the beer tap, barely glancing over his shoulder. Busy serving the local crowd. What he already knew they wanted, Ed wasn't looking for any new business tonight, he stayed with his pour. Ed had an epileptic tic where his face contorted and his tongue, stretched out of his mouth without his choosing but his condition, and obviously done nothing to dampen his superiority. As this saloon's concierge. A spot for my trailer with an open southern sky. I yelled across the bar, "A lot in the sky." He squawked, finally turning to see who this uninvited wahoo was already asking for things that weren't on the menu. "A spot with an open southern sky," I pointed, "so my satellite dish can get reception for the 9 o'clock football game." Now crossing to serve that beer he just poured. He glanced my way on his way by and said, "Nope." "Hey. Hey you," Matthew McConaughey, voice to my left, drunkenly asked, making sure to stake my ground and not appear to be an easy prey for their night entertainment. I answered in a semi-way. "Yeah, for 29 years, why? Too drunk to catch my dissa." Big smile came across the guy's face and he said, "See it, I knew it." He grabbed my hand and shook it. "I'm Sam, sit down here and let me buy you a drink. Introduce you to my Uncle Dave. He's on the right now. I'll be back in a minute." I decided this place looked more fun than a football game, and since they weren't offering the southern sky anyway, I obliged. "Let me take my dog for a walk and set up my trailer. Be back in 30. I left the bar to walk out when I heard a voice barked from behind the bar. "That'll be 11 bucks. Take any spot you want, they're all open." It was addition. 30 minutes later I walked back in and bellied up to the bar between Sam and his Uncle Dave. "What do you drink in Matthew Double Cuervo on the rocks?" I said loud enough Red to hear, but he didn't. "Hey sugar," Sam said to Asha, who was passing by, "get my good friend Matthew here a triple Cuervo on the rocks, will you, sweetie?" "Sure thing, Sam, and you know my name is Asha, so quit being afraid to call me by it," she said with a wink. I looked around the place. Everybody was smiling, flirting, finishing dinner, taking shots, dancing and playing slot machines, and had all been here before. It seemed, and most of them for years, especially Sam. "Hey honey bun, get us another round, will ya?" He flirted to another passing barmaid later, three more over here baby doll, he said to another the next time. I noticed that each time he called them by a general term of endearment. They each then asked him to call them by their own names instead. The girls were not threatened, they were not concerned with gender politics. If anything, they showed affection for him. Between rounds 4 and 5, Sam got up to go to the restroom. I asked his Uncle Dave, who had been quietly sitting on the other side of me the entire night. Hey, what was Sam calling every barmaid, sweetie, honey, baby or sugar? And then every barmaid asking him to call her by their real name instead. Uncle Dave took a sincere swig before look him in the eye and give me his answer. Sam lost his first and only wife 2 weeks after they were married 6 years ago. After 6 years of coming in here with him 6 nights a week, he still don't remember any of the barmaid's names as remembered or been able to say any woman's name since he can't. Around 3 a.m. with the bar thinned out, but the party far from over. I was rolling dice against the wall with a dozen of the late-night patrons. Jose, the tavern's hotel manager, was 35 years old, had crooked teeth, a receding hairline, a pair of 34-inch waist dickie pants, leather belted around her 26-inch midsection, a loyal black Labrador by her side, and a 13-month-old son sleeping in the baby carriage on the floor next to her. All credit to a one-night stand. She had a little over 2 years back when she was traveling through here just like me. And met a dude named Jack in this very bar where they proceeded to head to his hotel room and up for the night. When she woke up the next morning, Jack was gone, but his black lab was still bedside, so she hung around the place for a while and a couple of months later she found out she was pregnant. Tonight Jose was rolling the dice for a new set of tires, cause last month I drove 8 miles on the flat one and ruined the other 3. Then there was Donnie, an organic mushroom farmer who was currently living in a cabin with Donna the drunker. He got the more sentimental and concerned. He got about all the locals thinking he was sleeping with Donna D&D. Everyone kept teasing them. You see, Donna was married but her man had to take a drilling job in Alaska where he'd been working for the last year. She admitted she thought about up with Donnie because, well, he's a man and I'm a woman who said I'm just helping him out cause he don't have a place to stay. And I got an extra room. Donna had 2 master's degrees, but degrees don't get you too far in Montana, she said. I work at the Humane Society 50 miles from here in Missoula all day. And then I bartend here at night. Then she showed me the hair she'd been growing on her legs and armpits since August, getting ready for winter, she said. Bill and Susie had been married 22 years and ran a bar 50 miles up the road that never paid for itself, so they retired from working altogether. Susie swore that being the mother to Bill's 2 teenage sons from his previous marriage was a lot harder than making that bar stay open. Bill said that Montana's greatest export is his kids. Primary education was excellent and most parents were good ones, but since it was so hard to make a living in this state, all the kids leave to find work. But once they make enough money to get by, they all moved back home cause there's nothing like Montana. Glad they didn't have a spot with an open southern sky. Green Line. One of the great freedoms of trailer life is that you can hit you up, leave and find a new backyard whenever you want. Chase down sporting events, concerts, boondock in the desert, wake up to a grizzly, bear out your window on an Idaho River morning hike through the Antelope Valley of Utah. Meet people like I did in Montana or get a Port Authority escort through Times Square in New York City. But you also need a place to get your mail. I especially like the Golden Colorado summers and the Austin, Texas autumns. So I got a P.O. box at a park in each one. These 2 destinations served as home base is for me to address is where Miss Hud and I would stop and stay a while, read my mail hardwired to city amps and water, hang out with old friends and plan our next adventure. Prescribe. White collar prayers. You ever been to a Baptist church in the Deep South? They pray real prayers. They pray for things they need God. If I'm sick, bring me a doctor. God. If I'm sued, bring me a lawyer. God, if I'm cold, bring me a blanket. God, if I'm hungry, bring me some food. Blue-collar prayers. Then there's the privilege prayers. They pray fake prayers. They pray for things they want. God, help me win this game. God, make mama buy me that dress. God, get me an Oscar nomination. God, let me get that yacht. White-collar prayers. We need to quit asking God to answer these type of prayers, y'all. He's busy trying to get a new set of tires. Part 5. Turn the page. October 23, 1999. After over 3 years on the road, Miss Hutton, I started hankering for a tad more domesticity, cleaner sheets, a full kitchen, and some more water pressure. Sounded like Shangri-La. So I decided to rent a two-bedroom house in the sleepy little neighborhood of Tarrytown, in the heart of Austin, Texas. Besides the autumns and going to college there, I liked Austin because it always let me be myself. It's really the secret of why Austin is so cool. All you have to be in Austin is you, and Austin appreciates it when you are. He's never needed proof of me in a picture, and it's always just been happy to see me. Tarrytown was the kind of neighborhood where dogs ran off the leash. Kids could chase a ball into the street without looking for oncoming cars, and grandparents hadn't changed their addresses since they were born there. I had a garden to tend to, a one-hitter to hit before I did, and my alma mater's football season to watch live. It was late Saturday afternoon and Darrell K. Royal Memorial Stadium when my 18th-ranked Texas Longhorns had just beaten the undefeated and number 3 nationally ranked Nebraska Cornhuskers 24-20, handing the Huskers their only defeat of the season. The city was on fire and so was I. It was time to celebrate. I partied through the night into Sunday and through Sunday night without sleeping a wink. Bumper sticker: if you're high enough, the sun's always shining. At 2:30 that Monday morning, I finally decided to wind down. It was time to lower the lights, get undressed, open up the window, and let the jasmine scent of my garden come inside. It was time to smoke a bowl and listen to the beautiful African melodic beat Savinary Takonga play through my home speakers. It was time to stand over my drum set and follow the rhythm of the blues before they got to Memphis on my favorite Afro-Cuban drum-borne ceremony and speaking in tongues. The Congress. For me, the congas, bongos, and djembe have always been there. Purest and most instinctual instruments, no sticks, no electricity, no equalizer, no strings, no tools or amendments. Just skin to skin with the most analog spoken language. Prayer and dance known to man, the percussion, the root of music from the roots of music Africa. It was time to lose my mind and it take flat into the haze and slip into the dream. It was time for a jam session. What I didn't know is that while I was banging away in my bliss to Austin, policemen also thought it was time to barge into my house unannounced, wrestle me to the ground with nightsticks, handcuff me and pinned me to the floor. Oh, look at what we got here. The roided-up cop with her crew cut, who looked like a Nebraska Cornhusker himself, said as he read the driver's license he picked up off my coffee table. Then he picked up the bong and looky what we got here, Mr. McConaughey, you are under arrest for disturbing the peace. Possession of marijuana and resisting arrest. He proudly stated while squatting atop me in my back. You broke into my house. Yeah, I resisted, that's enough. He grunted, then wrangled me to my feet. We're taking you downtown. The other officer, the more civil one of the two, grabbed a blanket off the couch and moved to wrap it around my body. Oh no, 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 I barked. I'm not putting on my naked proof, I was minding my own business. They escorted me out of my house through the courtyard entry on the way to the street, still naked and reluctant to submit to the inevitability of my predicament. I got relative and decided it would be a clever idea to run up the walls left and right at the gated passageway and do a somersault backflip over the Cornhusker cop who was guiding me from behind. Now my thinking was that in mid-flight, while upside down in the air, I would assume a pike position and then slide my cuffed wrist under my and up and over my legs, then stick the landing behind the Cornhusker cop. Now with my feathered hands in front of me, my rationale at the time is that after pulling off such an extraordinary Houdini-like stunt, the officers would be so impressed that they would abrogate the arrest and set me free. I know, stupid, but remember I had been celebrating for 32 and a half hours straight. Whether my plan of action was physically possible or not, I'll never know. It didn't happen. Instead, before I'd taken 3 steps up the wall, the Cornhusker body slammed main back down onto the brick footpath. Meanwhile, word must have spread over the police scanner as to just who had been arrested, because there on the street were 6 lit-up cop cars and about 40 of my neighbors. You sure you don't want this blanket? The civil cop asked again. Hell no, I don't. This is proof of my innocence. I yelled to everyone on the block and one more over. They lowered my head, put me in the back of the patrol car and drove me to the precinct after we landed, and I declined the third offer to wear the blanket. We headed up the steps toward the entrance of the Austin Police Department at the double doors to admissions. A 6'6", 285-pound tatted-up working inmate greeted me just outside the entryway. He was holding a pair of men's orange institutional pants before we could say a word. I said proof of my innocent, man. He just looked at me, seeming to understand, but knowing better. We are all innocent, man. Trust me, you do want to put these on. Maybe it was his honest eyes or the fact that he was a fellow offender. Or maybe it was the sudden realization that when a 6-foot-6-inch jailbird built like a brick tells you you do want to put on some pants before you go in the clink, it's probably best to listen. Okay, he dropped to his knees.